Doe versus Smith. Is it Greenermeyer?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Greenermeyer.
Good morning, judges. Thank you for your time this morning, and may it please the court. My name is Zach Greenermeyer, and I'm here with Jeff Filipovitz on behalf of Jane Doe, who's here today. The method of analysis this court prescribes in evaluating a warrant against claims of material falsehoods or omissions is to extract the falsehoods and add the omissions, and then determine whether probable cause exists. In this case, extracting the false statements only, the effective text of the warrant is that Doe committed the offense of cruelty to children by going on a vacation with her boyfriend. Including the omitted exculpatory facts, at least two things would need to be noted in the warrant. First, that Doe behaved in perfect accordance with the uniform advice of a wide variety of professionals familiar with the facts, and she also behaved in perfect accordance with daily practice for a year. Second, the warrant would need to note that her father and brother disregarded her explicit instructions for child care during a brief vacation. Plaintiffs,
let me cut to the chase of what I think is troubling me about the case. When I look at what the investigator has, there was a division investigator who had written in a comment log that Doe gave approval for the girls to go over to the house. And then we know that R.L. had said that every time she went over there, that she had been touched inappropriately. And then we know that R.L. at least had said that Doe had provided permission for the daughters to stay over at the house that weekend. I know that there's conflicting evidence, but it does seem to me that the investigator could credit all of that and discredit and disbelieve the denials of that by other members of the family, and go forward based on that. Why am I wrong?
So you identified three facts that kind of fall into two categories. First, that Doe gave permission, as noted in a defects report, and that RL said that there was some permission, right? There's no dispute that Doe gave some permission for a short visit. The question is the scope of that visit and the time.
Yeah, but I thought that RL had told the investigator that Doe had given permission for them to stay over for the weekend.
Okay, so that's, I mean, I was first addressing the part about the defects report, because there's no dispute that there was some permission, but as to RL, right? And if we're looking at the question of what was the time that was allowed, we need to look at this under the totality of the evidence. So in this case, we have six adult witnesses who were all eyewitnesses who have a firmer basis of knowledge.
All of whom this investigator could think also have motives that maybe not to tell the complete truth. Sometimes they say, out of the mouth of babes, and I'm just wondering if you're in the if you're the investigator, you're trying to figure out, you know, who's telling the truth. Yeah. You don't have to credit what the adults are saying, do you?
If I may, a couple points on this, right? Two of the statements were statements that, if Smith's theory of the case is correct, were effectively confessions, that they did it, right? So we have a situation here where we're trying to figure out who did the thing, right? And it's like a who ran the red light, right? We have six people who were there, two people confess, and everybody says it wasn't Doe.
Haven't we said, though, as a matter of law, I understand where you're going. You're saying that RL is not credible and these people were very credible, but haven't we specifically said in our published case law that in the probable cause context, it's not, we don't expect officers to resolve credibility determinations or to, no, we don't pick apart conflicts and evidence as long as there is some credible evidence from which they can make the conclusion, which is what Judge Bill Pryor is talking about. We generally, at least for arguable probable cause purposes, give them that, look at that evidence to support it or not.
So a couple points on that. With the probable cause determination is always a totality of the evidence, right? And the cases where you know, we look at a police officer crediting a witness, those cases rely on a criminal victim reporting a crime that they have firsthand knowledge of. RL in this case doesn't have that firm foundation to know. There's a serious doubt. How would she know this?
She's a family member who was sleeping over that night with the children that weekend. How does she not have knowledge about why the children were there or how they got there?
A couple things. First, I think that especially an 8-year-old child, which is the case here, can reasonably infer in the absence of any other information before her that permission was given from the fact that it happened, right?
Well, that's not what she did here. What she said was they came over and she ascribed a reason to it because the kids did not like staying with their uncle. And I know there was an issue with Aaron or Donald or who that was, but that there was an issue, right? So she ascribed a reason for that purpose. It wasn't just she assumed it.
She had, of all the people in this case, she had the least basis to know. And in the face of that conflict of evidence, in the face of there not being a time crunch, as was said in the Daniels v. Bango case, you can look at the totality of the circumstances, and the totality of the circumstances don't give rise to probable cause.
And well, there's no doubt an officer could look at the same facts and conclude otherwise. So I don't think you're not wrong what you're saying. I guess what I'm asking is, why can't an officer look at this totality and say, you know what, I'm erring on the side of, and again, arguable probable cause allows for errors, and it could have been enough for a warrant in this case.
Again, I think if the officer is going to rely on a statement from one witness who has the least basis to know, to the total exclusion of confessions and other statements by people who would have a much firmer basis to know, at a minimum that calls for greater investigation. Smith didn't ask the key questions of, you know, what authority was given to Doe's kids, to really even the people, you know, these people told her, but Doe didn't.
Didn't she also have the corroborating fact, as Judge Bill Pryor told you, from the 2015 DFAX report that Doe had given permission?
There's no dispute that Doe gave permission.
Reading that with RL, couldn't an officer conclude that there was corroborating evidence of that fact?
I still think no under the totality of the circumstances and under the investigation that was done. But that's a part of our argument, right? That only a short visit was authorized. And during that short visit, Donald and Aaron's testimony was that Doe's understanding was that they were going to be there too, right? So the three adults watching six kids, right?
But one of the problems here is that, you know, this is so at this. This after the fact investigation is after Doe's come home. Everybody knows there's been a bad incident. Everybody knows there's an investigation. And the adults certainly know that the implications for that are very serious, right?
Correct.
And they know that there could be some bad stakes for some of the adults. That RL RL's less aware of.
I think the
I mean, so I mean, you seem to be ascribing to the investigator a requirement that everything that the adults are saying be taken at face value and in good faith, when there may be motives that the investigator has to contemplate that that cut in a couple of different directions.
And I think, you know, going back to the metaphor of who figuring out who ran the stoplight, for example, right? If we have six people who all say one person did it and two confessions.
This is a lot more serious than a red light.
Understood. And point taken. The other point that I would like to make that...
And everybody at the red light might not be related and realize, oh gosh, somebody could be going to prison over this.
The other point that I would make that would, is independently sufficient from our perspective to fully vitiate probable cause is the advice of the professionals. The advice of the professionals comes from DFACs, school officials, law enforcement, and counselors, all of whom had investigated this situation at least once, who were familiar with the kids, familiar with the situation, and told Doe that this was okay to do.
All Smith knew was that Doe and Donna, I'll use the colloquial name if you don't mind, told Smith that they had gotten that permission. That's all Smith knew, right?
So Smith knew more than that. Smith had the reports.
Well, let me also fast forward because you're short on time. Haven't we said that for the arguable probable cause determination that affirmative defenses generally need not be presented there, and we've said it in the context of good faith defenses?
So I have 2 points on that. First is that this is not a affirmative defense. This is an alibi kind of situation where if she did this with an innocent mind, there's no crime, right? Period. And second, there are cases in this court where if an affirmative defense is clearly established, then there's not even arguable probable cause.
Not a published case, right?
The case that I think is most on point is the most
an
extreme
unpublished
one
decision.
Is Wilson versus Sermons, which is unpublished. But I still think that this is more like an alibi. I see that my time is up.
May I ask one more question?
Yeah.
Even with the public authority, even with this permission that was given and that was communicated to Inspector Smith, did anyone give permission for a 4-night sleepover?
No. That wasn't a question that was asked, but each of the professionals' advice was unequivocal. It just said, RL is safe to be around.
Supervised, and no one gave permission for 3 or 4 nights. I just want to be clear.
That's correct.
Right.
That's all.
Okay, Mr. Rodham.
May it please the court. Investigator Smith captured the essence of this case well when she testified in her deposition that these children didn't have to be molested for the second time. The key fact that drove this entire investigation was that this was the second time that at least one of plaintiff's children had been molested at this same house by this same cousin on a prior occasion. Occasion actually involved all three of her children.
She knew more than that, didn't she? She knew about a 2013 incident?
Yes.
She knew about a 2014 incident, which happened 2 weeks before the grandparents' visit, or the visit to the paternal grandparents in Florida, right?
Yes.
And in that report, wasn't it the paternal grandmother's concern that the mom sort of fluffed this off as just, it's a family thing and we don't need to take this seriously?
Yeah, I don't want to get any agencies involved.
And we also have at least indications from one of the child that every time they would go over to RL's house that right. This would happen.
Right, and plaintiff in her interview with Investigator Smith said, I talk to my children all the time about molestation. And so when you have a child in a forensic interview saying, I get molested every time I go to that house, and you have plaintiff saying, I talk to my children all the time about this, a reasonable officer can assume from those statements The mother knows bad things are still going on at that house. And she's still letting her kids go to that house. And Smith had the DFACS intake reports where their expressed concern was, this has happened before at this house. Mother's still letting the kids go back to this house. What is she doing to protect her kids?
So your opposing counsel says, and you have to admit, you put a lot of weight on RL's statement that about the sleepover. And I think a lot of the case hinges on that. Your opposing counsel gets up here and tells us that is not credible and no reasonable officer would rely on that testimony for any number of reasons. And their brief lays out, I think, four or five reasons why she's not credible. Tell me why opposing counsel is not correct about that and why a reasonable officer could have relied for arguable probable cause purposes.
Well, I think plaintiff... misunderstands the nature of a forensic interview. A forensic interview, it's not an interrogation, nor is it a cross-examination. It is an interview by a trained interviewer where the purpose of the interview is to find out the facts of what happened. And so the interviewer is not going to, you know, is not bound by the rules of evidence, probably doesn't even know the rules of evidence. And so the interviewer is not going to go into the niceties that we would probably go into if we were doing the interview. And is not going to ask some of the questions that we would like to have asked. And so while there are questions we would have liked to have asked, it is notable that the forensic interviewer testify in her deposition that this child was coached. And yet, even though she was coached, she still stated in her forensic interview that it was plaintiff who made the decision for her children to spend the weekend at that house because she did not want her kids staying with her brother because he's mean to them. That sounds exactly like an explanation that would be given to a child. I can see an adult giving that explanation to a child. Here's why your cousins are going to be staying with you. Because, well, I don't want them to stay with Aaron. He's mean.
Your opposing counsel also says that there was an affirmative defense here, or at least a negation of intent, that was significant. The mother and the mother of the children and her mother both told them that the mental health professionals, counselors, that Children's Protective Services all said that it was okay because she was in counseling for her children to be with RL in a supervised setting. And that was ultimately what Doe intended to happen.
Well, I think that...
Is an officer required to present that to a magistrate judge?
Not in this case, because here's what the guidance was. The guidance was it is okay for plaintiff's kids to be around the cousin. I don't know what be around means. It has never been explained in this case. Going to the same school with the cousin is different from having a four-night sleepover with the cousin. Those are very different situations which require very different supervisory arrangements. And it seems that plaintiff took this guidance as, well, as long as one adult is present, then everything's okay.
I know the briefs use the term exculpatory evidence. It's not a great term because Brady really comes up in the trial context and is derives from trial rights and not from pre-arrest rights. But shouldn't we want prosecutors to present exculpatory evidence to a magistrate judge, even if ultimately saying, I don't believe this and here's why I don't believe it, but here's the defense that has been presented and here's evidence which contradicts my theory?
I think there are cases where an officer may be expected to present such exculpatory evidence where such evidence is has more of a has more of a firmer basis. You know, maybe there's physical evidence that may support the suspect's story to some degree.
So you're saying because it came, the evidence mostly came from the mother and the mother's mother, that the officer is allowed to make a credibility determination of whether to present that to the magistrate judge?
Well, I think so, because we're looking at double and triple hearsay.
That's always going to be the case for a search warrant, though, or for an arrest warrant. It's one officer swearing out about what they heard. I mean, that's always going to be the case.
Well, it is, but if all they're given is they said it's okay for my kids to be around this cousin, that doesn't tell the officer much of anything. If they said the cousin's therapist said that it was okay for my kids to have a 3 or 4 night sleepover at the cousin's house with Jimmy being supervision, that would be a different situation, probably.
Well, what about the information that the father and the brother disregarded Ms. Doe's instructions?
Well, that's interesting, because number one, we don't have any testimony from Donald at all. We have hearsay from plaintiff and from Aaron. Aaron doesn't admit to doing anything in his declaration. He throws Donald under the bus, just like plaintiff does. Again, that is simply just conflicting information with the other information that Smith had, and she was not required to credit that information because, you know, these adults had motive to, you know, make potentially false statements. You know, plaintiff was scared she was going to lose her kids. Right. There was testimony that when Smith obtained arrest warrants, there was a meeting at DFACS as to whether the cousin was going to be removed from Donna's home. And so there was a possibility that kids are going to be taken out of homes and put into foster care. So there's certainly a motivation for adults to change their story. And so Smith was not obligated to credit those statements since she had other information to the contrary. Now, if the court does not have further questions, I'll cede the remainder of my time.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Greenemeyer, you've got 4 minutes.
Thank you. A couple of responses opposing counsel's argument. With regard to RL's statement, if RL's statement is going to be taken against the mountain of other evidence, that's one thing. But the core question is, you know, was RL's statement, even on its own terms, reasonably trustworthy information? And I think there are serious doubts about that, as, you know, we've indicated in our briefing. she was the person with the least basis to know. It was a stray comment, and everyone else testified unequivocally about what happened. Opposing counsel said that this is a forensic interview, so it doesn't work quite the same. That's true, but at the same time, Smith can feed questions to the forensic interviewer and can ask that the interviewer ask those questions. And none of the children were specifically asked that question, which speaks to an investigation that was not reasonable and was not designed to get at this fact. Another point that hasn't been talked about yet is Smith's materially false statements to the magistrate about Jimmy being the prior offender. Smith's theory of the case from start to finish, as told to the prosecutor, as told to even the forensic interviewer, was that Jimmy was a known prior offender.
Didn't that come from Doe?
No.
I'm reading page 56 of Ms. Lewis Martin's deposition. Answer, I didn't know that up until then. Donna Lowry, Jimmy, let's back up. Jimmy had been in prison and had been released, and so-and-so had allowed him to come and move into her home. Question, now how did you learn that Jimmy had been in prison? Answer, Doe, it's a different name, obviously. Doe told me. Question, do you remember when Doe told you that? Answer, like I just stated, the date of these interviews.
So Doe specifically denied making that statement. That statement was made with Smith, forensic interviewer, and Doe altogether. This was one of the bases that Judge Batten reconsidered. He's in the original order, he said that basically what you just said, and then on reconsideration said, okay, we're not considering that fact.
But there's a conflict of evidence.
There's a conflict of evidence at best, yeah.
Yeah, he gave, it seems, every benefit of the doubt here. I mean, I thought that that order on the motion for reconsideration showed really the care with which Judge Batten treated this record.
Going back just one second to whether there's a conflict of evidence, here, this is not a situation where there's a conflicting evidence that an officer needs to sift through. Smith was in that conversation.
I understand.
It didn't happen.
There's a genuine issue of material judgment. Fact which inures to your benefit.
Okay,
I understand.
Right. And then finally, even if it was assumed that Jimmy was the only caregiver, and even if it was assumed, contrary to the evidence, that Donald and Aaron weren't also supposed to be there, there's still not evidence that Doe had any notion that Jimmy would be an inappropriate caregiver for reasons outlined in our brief. I see my time is up.
Thank you. We have your case. We are adjourned for the week.
All rise.